This is The Mary Davis Show, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with interviews, news, special features, and the community calendar. Now, here is your host, Mary Davis.
Good morning and welcome. I'm your host, Mary Davis. And of course, you know, it's The Mary Davis Show. And we have a returning guest who I love talking to. Comes on from time to time when she can get through all of her duties that she has to do. And that's the Honorable Barbara Nevergold. And she is with us this morning. As you know, Barbara is a member of the Buffalo School Board, and she has at one time been the president of that board, and she is now, I believe, just at-large board member. And she has been having her share of problems with some others. But this morning we'll talk about some general things going on with the board, what can be expected now. There is a new superintendent in place. What reasonably can be expected from him? And what can the four minority members expect, female members expect? It's going to be business as usual, you know, and if they have to wear a padded helmet to board meetings, or, you know, a bulletproof vest, you know, or, you know, or try to get a big target off their backs or whatever when they go to board meetings. So we'll be discussing some general issues that are going on with the board and what we can look forward to in the rest of 2015 and 2016. And particularly, what kind of hopes and, well, I would say aspirations do we have for the new superintendent? And I hate to say this, but it seems as though, and although a lot of times, particularly men, seem to think they have easier, softer targets with women, and since we have a male superintendent, we'll see if that applies there as well. Although the outgoing temporary superintendent did have his share of problems after a while and left, so maybe that does not apply. But we're going to find out. After saying all that, Barbara, good morning.
Good morning, Mary. How are you?
I'm pretty good, and yourself?
I'm well, thank you.
So what is going on? What do you think? What are some of the aspirations?
Oh, my. You know, as you said, it is a busy time. There's a lot going on in the district. But let me start with, I think, positive, and that is the hiring of a new superintendent, Dr. Kreiner Cash. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Cash comes to us with lots of experience, mm-hmm. with having been the superintendent of the Memphis School District.
That's a big district, I think, Memphis.
Very big. I'm forgetting how many, but it's probably 2 to 3 times larger than Buffalo.
Okay, so that's huge, yeah.
And he also worked as the superintendent in Martha's Vineyard, which mm-hmm. is probably a much smaller district.
And probably a much wealthier one than that.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. But he comes with a broad, wealth of experience. Mm-hmm. I think that he is an individual who not only has the knowledge, the educational mm-hmm. knowledge that we need to have in a superintendent, mm-hmm. but he has, I think, people skills, mm-hmm. and I think he has the political wisdom mm-hmm. to navigate in this community, mm-hmm. Given that one of the,
That's a pretty positive picture. I'm just wondering, have you had an opportunity to sit down, say, one-on-one or in a small group to talk with him?
I've had an opportunity to sit down and talk with him one-on-one. Mm-hmm. He did that shortly after taking over mm-hmm. And met with each of the board members to give us an opportunity to meet with him. And you know, we'll mm-hmm. be meeting certainly regularly, mm-hmm. Not only as a board, but I intend to meet with him regularly as mm-hmm. a board member. But I'm very impressed, as I said, about his, his ability to kind of understand people and get an idea of what people are like mm-hmm. early on. Certainly, one of the things that was said about why we needed a local person mm-hmm. was that it was somebody who could hit the ground running, mm-hmm. who didn't have to learn about people, places, and things, mm-hmm. Buffalonian. Mm-hmm. But he seems like an individual who has the capability mm-hmm. of hitting the ground running and learning that part of the job very
quickly. That's got to be a big plus.
Yes, it is mm-hmm. a big plus. It is a big plus.
So you're looking kind of forward. So your first impression of him was pretty positive.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that all of the board members mm-hmm. Certainly had an opportunity to interview him. Mm-hmm. Were very positively impressed, mm-hmm. and we saw him very early on as a front runner.
Mm-hmm. And that's even the majority members of the board.
Even the majority members of the board.
Because I knew there had been some coming out of the majority. I think it was maybe Mr. Palladino, but I'm not absolutely sure. And I don't want to put something on him. He has enough on him as it is, I think, without me adding anything more. But who was kind of worried about the idea that they were looking at an African-American person.
Well, he did say something about affirmative action and about pleasing the African-Americans on the board. And he was against that. Certainly, he had his candidates that he was pushing very, very strongly.
It's going to be my way, candidates, or the highway?
Somewhat like that, or something about a career-ending casket. I think that was the terminology he used regarding Dr. Cash. Since that time, I think he seems to have come around a little bit. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, definitely this is a time when we all need to come together, put away some of our differences, and try to back this man so that the district doesn't get harmed any more than it has been.
This sounds like a pretty rosy observation, but when I'm thinking about the make of the majority, it seems to me as though it might be a bit too rosy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm a positive thinker. Mm-hmm. I try to be positive, but I'm also pragmatic, and certainly. I understand what you're saying, but I think that we have to initiate this new tenure of the superintendent with a positive, forward-thinking attitude. Otherwise, you know, we could sink very quickly under the idea that we can't work together. So that's what we're doing, and we'll just say that time will tell. Certainly. Mm-hmm. How all of this is going to turn out.
Mm-hmm. That is one way of putting it. What are the things that you think reasonably, looking at the makeup of the board basically hasn't changed. So there are at least, this is the ninth month now, so you're talking about three more months at least in 2015. Mm-hmm. With the makeup of the board as it is, and the only thing that's different now is Dr. Cash,
right.
What do you think could be accomplished?
Well, I tell you, we have some very serious mandates that are being required of the district by entities outside of the district that have a great deal of control. Mm-hmm. One is the Federal Office of Civil Rights, and the other is the State Education Department.
Was there ever anything, who was the gentleman here, the educator, I forget his name, he's a very prominent person that was coming here to do some evaluations.
Dr. Gary Orfield.
Yeah, and got thoroughly insulted by Mr. Palladino, and I thought that he was going to bring something up. Did he ever follow through on that, or did he just say, well, the heck with it, I'm not going to worry about it?
No, absolutely. Well, that's he worked for the Office of Civil Rights.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I'm saying that it's a very serious situation that we have now. We were found in violation of admissions equality or equity for children of color. Dr. Orfield essentially came and interviewed people and did a study about the whole situation and made some very pointed recommendations that
he got thoroughly dissed, I guess, by Mr. Palladino.
Well, he did. Most certainly he did. But, you know, he represents the Office of Civil Rights.
Mm-hmm.
He is not the Office of Civil Rights. Mm-hmm. And so while Mr. Palladino could diss Dr. Orfield, he's not able to do that. Because the Office
the
of
Department.
Civil Rights controls a great deal of funding that would be in jeopardy if we do not find a way to respond appropriately to the recommendations that Dr. Orfield made.
So Mr. Palladino felt that he could get away with, say, like giving a kick to Dr. Orfield and that nothing would happen, only to find out that maybe he's going to find that there can be a kick coming back his own way. But instead of just punishing him, it seems though he would punish not only the board, but all the kids that go to school here in Buffalo.
Right. It's the children who will suffer from that. It's the district who will suffer from not complying with the recommendations.
For something stupid.
So, yes. So we have a lot of work to do with respect to Dr. Orfield's recommendations and coming up with a plan that is going to execute those recommendations.
Have they started on that plan? Has anything been started on yet? Or is it kind of like in limbo?
No.
Just sort of feeling the way, we're trying to gather information.
No, we had some very definite deadlines mm-hmm. from the Office of Civil Rights, I call it OCR. Mm-hmm. We had some definite deadlines, and we made the deadlines, but we were it was not acceptable. Mm-hmm. The plan was not acceptable. So there was a plan. It was submitted.
How much input did, say, minority members have in this?
Well, this is
you said it wasn't acceptable. I'm just wondering, did you guys get a chance to get anything in there?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a plan that was developed by staff that mm-hmm. the board had to approve. Mm-hmm. And so we most definitely looked at it mm-hmm. And thought that it was meeting mm-hmm. What was recommended, but mm-hmm. OCR did not agree with us. Mm-hmm. And so now it's been kicked back, mm-hmm. and now it's in the hands of Dr. Cash, mm-hmm. and he is preparing another response.
You have to go through the whole thing.
25th.
I mean, could you just maybe, well, we didn't like the date. I mean, something as simple as, well, okay, we'll change the date here. Or we didn't like the number 100 that you put in here. Well, we'll change it to 200. Mm-hmm. Is it something simple that you could do? You have to revise the entire thing.
I think it's more complex. I think there's mm-hmm. some things perhaps that will be acceptable, but I think it's more complex in terms mm-hmm. of some clear recommendations that Dr. Orfield made that the OCR did not think that we addressed. Mm-hmm. So we have to go back and really look at his recommendations mm-hmm. and address each and every one thoroughly.
Those recommendations to see what's going on. Mm-hmm. That is something else. And I imagine there was a lot of time and effort that went into that plan.
I think that it's been recognized that we had another superintendent mm-hmm. At the head of the organization mm-hmm. at the time.
Dr. Brown.
It wasn't Dr. Brown. It was Mr. Ogilvie.
Mr. Ogilvie, okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Ogilvie essentially was the superintendent
sort of like
at the point.
Wasn't he sort of a hand-picked person? He was kind of the hand-picked person, I believe, wasn't he?
Mr. Ogilvie, mm-hmm. yes, was the person who was...
He was handpicked and was going to do as he's told.
Essentially appointed by the majority members.
Well, he's a puppet, basically. He was supposed to be, maybe proved a little bit different.
Right. I think it proved very different. He was not a puppet. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, I want to make sure that we understand that he was not a puppet. Mm-hmm. I think that he really saw mm-hmm. the issues and the problems that the district was facing mm-hmm. and knew that it needed a different approach than was demanded of him.
That must have been a shock to majority. I'm wondering, I know that every board member had a chance to meet individually with Dr. Cash, mm-hmm. but did you also have an opportunity when he was more or less picked, appointed, christened, or whatever else, with Mr. Ogilvie?
No, we didn't, and that absolutely was a bone of contention mm-hmm. with his hiring, because he was essentially recruited mm-hmm. and contracted with and brought to the table without ever meeting with any of mm-hmm. the four minority board members.
Mm-hmm. So you guys didn't know a thing about, more or less, you knew his name, I'm sure, like that, but really have to have a sit down and talk with him about things.
Not.
You just had no opportunity for that.
Not before he was hired. No, mm-hmm. we didn't. So, mm-hmm. That was a problem. That's an issue. Mm-hmm. So, again, the way in which Dr. Cash has been hired mm-hmm. certainly has been very different. Mm-hmm. And as I said, for that reason, maintaining a optimistic outlook mm-hmm. Because everyone was involved. Everyone was, mm-hmm. was engaged in the process.
Well, to keep that from being repeated, what did you have to do to make it plain to the majority board members that there was going to have to be some changes in the way things were, at least the hiring thing was going to be done?
Well, I think it was plain from the outset of Mr. Ogilvie's tenure mm-hmm. because while we were not involved in hiring him, we very definitely expressed our concerns mm-hmm. and our opposition to the manner in which mm-hmm. he was hired, and that to the entire board, that to the public, and that to mm-hmm. Mr. Ogilvie mm-hmm. directly.
That's been a shock. I mean, just imagine the majority when they thought they were getting one thing and they got something else. That would have had to have been a really big shock.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I you mentioned the word puppet, mm-hmm. and I think that... very few people, will allow themselves, if they have any integrity, mm-hmm. Any intelligence mm-hmm. in the field in mm-hmm. which they are working in, will allow themselves to be a puppet. And certainly Mr. Ogilvie did not allow himself mm-hmm. to be a puppet.
I think that must have been a really big shock to the majority, because from what I remember reading in the paper and talking to different people, it was fully expected by majority, certainly by Mr. Palladino, mm-hmm. that they had Mr. Ogilvie on a very short leash, mm-hmm. and he would sit up when he was told to sit up, lay down when he was told to lay down, and whatever else, only to find that that was not going to be the case.
No, that
there was an independent streak down this guy's back that no one knew was there.
Exactly. And I think it also speaks to the fact that the situation in the school district is a complex one, mm-hmm. and someone who isn't an educator or someone who isn't really paying attention and mm-hmm. reading and making sure they understand mm-hmm. what's going on cannot direct the person that they want to direct to do things. And mm-hmm. I think that was another
part. It is in
the
case with a whole lot of issues. We can see that in the case of many things that are going on in government. I think a classic example of some of that, from what I can gather from the news, this is strange, just a little bit off of education, but just to follow up on the point that you were making, sometimes you never know what you're going to get mm-hmm. until it's there. And that's what the Republican Party, who thought they were going to get one thing, and suddenly find themselves with a big, fat revolt mm-hmm. among not only just primary voters, but the base of their party.
Sure.
And more or less the establishment who runs the party, suddenly looking at this totally out-of-control base mm-hmm. who wants
yeah,
something
different. It's a
different
era. Yeah. It's a different era that we're in now. Mm-hmm. And people are certainly I think the technology mm-hmm. has made a tremendous difference in the mm-hmm. way which people communicate mm-hmm. and what they communicate and how mm-hmm. quickly they can communicate it.
Mm-hmm. Right? And I would imagine, I said, good grief, that's probably an enormous kind of issue mm-hmm. because that would be something that could reach up sometimes and slap you right in the face, particularly when you're used to one thing. And I guess after listening to a lot, and again, I'm just going back to a national news because it seems like there's a parallel here. Mm-hmm. And I've not only did it cross my mind, but I've heard some other people voice this talking heads more or less, that a personality like Mr. Trump is used to a lot of yes people. Mm-hmm. And people, when you say jump, the only thing that they ask is how high.
Right.
You know, and I think in a way with Mr. Ogilvie, is he a doctor or just Mr.?
No.
And I'm saying that maybe when they were looking for that, particularly perhaps Mr. Palladino, who was the only opinion that you were reading in the paper about this, was that he basically is used to telling people what to do and a lot of flunkies or yes people around him that simply say how high.
Right.
And it was kind of like a shock maybe to get that all at once he thought that this that was nothing else to do but say, I want you to do this, that, and the other, it would be done, mm-hmm. only to suddenly discover that this man, there was a little revolt going on here.
Yeah. Well, and I think there was an expectation as well that certain things could be accomplished quickly, mm-hmm. and that's not the case, mm-hmm. Particularly, again, when you're dealing with various entities, when you're mm-hmm. dealing with regulations, mm-hmm. you know, when you're dealing with people. Sometimes you think that you can accomplish something mm-hmm. in a very short period of time that really takes three times mm-hmm. as long.
Could that have been the problem with Mr. Ogilvie, perhaps not being, say, maybe not being primarily involved in educational issues, that he didn't realize some of the things on this board that might come up, that he may not could just say, okay, you're going to do this, and that was going to be the end of it?
No, Mr. Ogilvie has an extensive history in education. He's mm-hmm. been a superintendent.
Mm-hmm. So he knew.
He was the superintendent of BOCES for about mm-hmm. 20 years and had just mm-hmm. retired. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that he was not aware mm-hmm. of what needed to be accomplished. I think it was the board members who mm-hmm. were pushing him that didn't understand.
But he did understand there's going to be some things that maybe I need to walk a little tread lightly here.
Exactly.
You know, and I can't do what you're demanding, snap my fingers and this is going to be done overnight. Exactly. There's other things here.
Right. As I said, you know, there are laws and regulations that mm-hmm. That govern how things are done mm-hmm. in education. And so not being aware of that or, mm-hmm. or not wanting to accept that you cannot just snap your fingers and overnight, you know, turn a school into a charter school, mm-hmm. Is one of the realities that mm-hmm. we're dealing with. And I know that Mr. Ogilvie was certainly aware of all mm-hmm. you know, of the issues that mm-hmm. would impact any decision, but it isn't you know, I'm not sure that he was given the opportunity to explain that before he was expected to do it.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. I'm sitting here thinking about it. Of course, you'd have no way of knowing this, neither do I. I'm just doing some surmising here. It would seem as though that maybe this was one time, and again, since Mr. Palladino's name was the only one really out there that was doing these things, probably overestimated or so used to people when he says jump and they say how high, that this was kind of a shock to him that there would be this type of, I wouldn't say major, maybe mini rebellion, that this person, you know, this is something I'm absolutely not going to do.
Right.
I have integrity here, or I think I know the law maybe in this instance better than you because I've dealt with it for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I kind of know that. And I'm just wondering if that could have been somewhat of a surprise for Mr. Palladino, because I'm sure that he thought that everything would run the way he wanted it to, only to suddenly find out that, no, that's not going to be the way it's going to go. Because it seemed to me, from what I could read in the paper, he was pretty upset.
Yes, he was. And he demanded Mr. Ogilvie's resignation. So that was, again, also not how this works, you know, with the with the Board of Education.
Was
one
minority
board
member
does not have the authority to do that.
Was the minority members of the board, or even the rest of them, but I would say especially minority members, I'm just assuming that Mr. Palladino talks to the majority, where he just probably does not talk to the minority. But were any of them surprised at his demand that this man resign? Did that catch you folks off guard?
Of course we were all surprised, again, because the superintendent does not report to a board member. The superintendent reports to the board.
To the board.
So it's up to the board to make decisions about employment decisions and not one individual on the board. So, yes, you know, that took us all by surprise.
I guess that's why I keep referring to the fact that I think that Mr. Palladino, like some are saying about Donald Trump, is used to having his way. You know, he's in a position where he is the employer or the one with the most money or whatever else, and having people do his bidding unquestionably, you know, and just, and that this was kind of like this type of blowback or this type of suddenly finding out that you are not the sole decision maker here. You know, there are other people here that also have to figure into these decisions. That must have been quite a shock, I think, for Mr. Palladino, who seemed to be operating, you know, just reading the newspaper, under the impression that he made the decisions and this was it.
Well, yes, as I said, that, you know, it was erroneous, an erroneous assumption. But unfortunately, Mr. Ogilvie certainly, I think, decided that at that point in time, it was time for him to, you know, to tender his resignation.
He just wouldn't do it that same day, I guess, that Mr. Palladino said to do it. Maybe that was his small rebellion. I'm just not going to do it today. You want it on Monday, and I'll wait till Friday.
Right.
Yeah, something like that, you know. That must have been something else. And you haven't been with us for a while. Tell us a little bit about yourself. We know that you're a PhD, and you've been in education for a while. Other than that, what's going on with Barbara Nevergo?
Oh, my goodness. Well, as you know, I am writing a column weekly that appears in the Challenger and the Criterion. And, you know, the purpose for that really started over a year ago when the new board took office. And it was a way to, I think, voice, you know, both my concerns and also to provide another perspective to what was happening. Our one, you know, one newspaper town does not get that perspective because the Buffalo News has, you know, has decidedly,
especially the editorial page,
right, particularly the editorial page, and it really has decided to marginalize and make either marginalize or demonize the African American woman on the board, and so there needs to be another perspective, and so I began to write the column weekly, and I also put it on a blog that I have. And so, you know, essentially what I used to do in terms of writing, African-American history and doing research on local history and writing about that, I've kind of put to the side for now because writing a column every week takes a lot of energy and time.
I know you and a longtime friend did this together.
Right, Dr. Bertram and I. Uh-huh. So we still maintain on Crown Community Builders. Mm-hmm. We still have our webpage up and continue mm-hmm. to add biographies to the webpage. Mm-hmm. But it's slowed down, so mm-hmm. it's not the same focus that I was able to have before.
I'm surprised that you went into the field of education, because I know that you come out of a more religious-oriented family. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't see, you know, a whole lot of difference yet, because mm-hmm. education, you know, religion is mm-hmm. has a major component of educating mm-hmm. people. But my parents, you know, were supportive of mm-hmm. all their children, wanting them to make sure they got the education mm-hmm. And to move as far and as high as you mm-hmm. could, because both of them were not able to mm-hmm. Graduate high school.
Did any of your siblings follow in your parents' footsteps?
In terms of the religious, no.
I would have thought that probably they would have. So you don't have any other pastors in your family.
I know. No, mm-hmm. no other pastors among my siblings. Certainly, you know, among the extended family there mm-hmm. are. Mm-hmm. But no one else took that path. They all mm-hmm. went different ways.
Different ways. Yeah. Anybody else in education other than yourself?
Thinking about it, no, actually not. We're pretty diverse. Yeah, and I have one, the youngest brother, as a matter of fact, is in television.
Isn't that something?
And in mm-hmm. news production. Mm-hmm. So he's in St.
Everybody
Saint
has
Louis.
Sort of
or
did something actually. Did something different.
Yeah, everyone uh-huh. did. Mm-hmm.
That must have been a shock. Are both your parents still alive?
No, they're not. Mm-hmm. No, they weren't shocked. They were very happy, you know, again, that uh-huh. that we, whatever path we took, you mm-hmm. know, that they were pleased with it, they mm-hmm. were able to. You know, survive and, mm-hmm. and to thrive in it. It's strange because my father did a lot of things, and one mm-hmm. of the things he did was to teach piano. Mm-hmm. And none of us learned how to play piano either. At least I have one brother now who's, as he's gotten older, has taken mm-hmm. it up. But mm-hmm. As children, none of us learned to play piano.
None of us. And how many of your siblings do you have?
There were 10 of us.
10, that's a large family.
Yeah, it is.
How many girls, how many boys?
Two girls.
Just two and eight and brothers?
Yeah.
Wow, that was really kind of lopsided.
Well, and the age span was two, uh-huh. so, mm-hmm. you know, they spanned it all the way from, well, at this point in time, 80 some odd years old mm-hmm. down to 50.
Isn't that
so
something?
So it's a 30-year span.
Man, right? Yeah. That was, your mother and father remind me of my great-grandmother, who was still having children when she was 50.
Mm-hmm.
Good women. What made you decide to go into education? I often wondered why you did. I know at a time, black women particularly either had two fields that they may have went into. They were either going to be social workers or basically teachers.
Or nurses.
Or yeah.
nurses. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I mean, coming from that particular time, in history, and now it almost seems historic.
A lot even still today.
Yeah, but I don't think it was just black women. I think mm-hmm. it was women.
Period.
Period. Mm-hmm. In education, be a teacher, mm-hmm. be a nurse, mm-hmm. instead of be a social worker. Mm-hmm. And there weren't too many other options that mm-hmm. you were given or encouraged to take.
Mm-hmm.
And so teaching for me was, you know, the way to
mm-hmm.
go.
Mm-hmm. Was your education primarily in Buffalo?
Primarily in Buffalo, mm-hmm. Buffalo State, and mm-hmm. you know, certainly a product of the Buffalo schools, mm-hmm. but college, Buffalo State,
mm-hmm.
UB.
Mm-hmm. Like, and you think back about it, would you have, now as you think back about it, you wish you had did something different?
I do. You know, mm-hmm. given everything that has happened over mm-hmm. the 50 years or so since I graduated from high school and mm-hmm. seeing what fields have been open to women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think something like the law mm-hmm. might have been an aspiration that mm-hmm. I would have considered.
Mm-hmm. You like the law?
Well, you know, I just think that, you know, in terms, again, of making an impact,
mm-hmm.
Attorneys, judges, mm-hmm. you know, that field allows you to move into that area. And so it still would have been something helping people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, again, as women, we're often oriented to helping,
mm-hmm. helping
people
yeah.
in
mm-hmm.
those professions. So that's why the teaching, you know, mm-hmm. the nursing, the social worker
mm-hmm.
are all helping professions.
Mm-hmm.
We don't tend to think of being an attorney as a helping profession, perhaps, mm-hmm. but it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably, you know, again, would have had something that would have been a helping profession.
Mm-hmm. Even to this day, I don't think there's that many African-American women lawyers. I'm just talking about right in Buffalo, and I know that Rose Conyers is getting ready to retire. She rose to the Supreme Court judge, I think, mm-hmm. and I think she's getting ready to retire. Of course, there was Barbara Sims, who is a relative of yours.
No, she's not. But okay. She was the first African American,
woman
judge.
Yeah,
yes.
And she was also a teacher too. I think she was.
She taught
also
in law
taught.
School.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So there was that came about, mm-hmm. and it's quite amazing because the way now I look around now, and I wonder sometimes I have a fear. For my people, I look and think, because I listen to people now, the political rhetoric that's going on nationally, and it makes you kind of fearful. You wonder, my goodness, where are we going? Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I look on the local scene, because you and Peggy Brooks Bertram, when you were first getting started, I think you ran for the school board at one time.
I did.
And
Some years before.
Mm-hmm. And I know at that particular time, we talk about how local politics has really changed. But, you know, there was a time when people used to basically think, I don't think this is anymore, because certainly not with me. I'm what we call a bullet voter. Mm-hmm. I don't matter what color you are. I kind of look at if we're on the same page, ideology or ideology. Mm-hmm. I always get these mixed up. I don't want to say ideology or ideology. But and I don't think a lot of people do. There was a time, you know, that person is black. We're going to vote for them. Mm-hmm. And that person, the only thing you may share is a skin color. And absolutely nothing else. And I think I can remember the hard time that you and both Peggy, Dr. Brooks, Bertram Brooks, struggled with mm-hmm. when you were running and being active. There was a lot of resistance. It came a lot from black men.
Well, yeah, and I think it's still prevalent mm-hmm. today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, looking at, we were just talking about the Maston District mm-hmm. race earlier. And there certainly was
a
female running,
and
the individual who ran against, or actually two individuals who ran against her. But, you know, the Common Council has not had a female council member mm-hmm. since Bonnie Russell retired.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a few years, mm-hmm. but I don't think that, and we could probably, if we thought about it, had a little time, name all of the female council members mm-hmm. in Buffalo over the history of the council,
mm-hmm.
and probably that would be on one hand.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you know, women in politics, again, is a career, yeah, that mm-hmm. really needs some attention.
Mm-hmm. To what's going on. That when you look back on those days, that period of time in your life, from a political point of view, or even social point of view, was that ever kind of a shock to you to think that there would be this opposition? I can remember some saying, because I know your husband and Dr. Brooks Bertram's husband are both white,
mm-hmm.
and that there were some things in there almost about you being a race traitor.
Really?
Basically, you know, how dare you, you know, want to come to us for this type of thing and look who you're married to.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed to me, as I've heard these things by these men, how dare you? And on top of the fact that you both highly educated, you had PhDs, mm-hmm. and how dare you have that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was like a double whammy,
yeah.
who you married and what you got upstairs in your brains.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. No one's ever said that to me personally. I certainly have heard it from other people like you have.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing about being married to person of who's not a person of color that stops me from being an African American woman who still has to face the same kind of discrimination,
mm-hmm.
The same kind of biases
mm-hmm.
That an African American woman mm-hmm. faces. Who I'm married to hasn't provided any kind of mm-hmm. Benefit
shield,
in that
armor.
Way or shield.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. That's a good mm-hmm. word. You know, hasn't done that whatsoever. Yeah. But I think as we look at what is happening in our country over this last decade or mm-hmm. so, and certainly heightened by the fact that we have an African-American president,
mm-hmm.
the first one, we realize that race has become a major issue, to deal with. We're not post-racial at all. And so I was listening to someone earlier this morning talking about the Ferguson Report. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but what they said is that, you know, we have difficulty in this country in talking about race. It's something that is hard to talk about, and it's emotional.
That black people remember and white people want to forget.
Yeah, and even, you know, again, intra-racial issues that come up, such as the gender issue that you mentioned. So there's a lot there that as a country and as communities that we're haven't faced because we can't talk about it.
And that can be a really big problem. It's some of the things that we're finding out when I listen to Mr. Trump, and he has some pretty, even if you are don't want a lot of immigration, it would be kind of hard, and you start to think, what would it cost particularly to round up 11 million people? Then how would you sort out those that may actually be legal? They all look alike maybe, but who actually be legal and those who are not? How would you go about doing that? It seemed to me that, well, Hitler managed to dispatch 6 million Jews, not counting the millions of Russians and gypsies and other and socialists and communists that he also sent to glory. It took him something like, I would say, that those things started perhaps in the late 30s when he came to power in 33. I'd imagine a lot of these things began happening with him about maybe 35, 36, and he was in power until 45. So you're talking about at least 13, 14 years, and he still didn't manage to totally get rid of every single Jew or every single Russian or every single gypsy. So how first of all, and I'm listening to Donald Trump, I'm saying to myself, first of all, how would you go about doing this, and what would the cost be?
I think a lot of people certainly, as they listen to him, are asking those practical, where are the practical policy statements? You know, how will you accomplish this? It's all well and good if this is, you know, this is what you believe and what you want to propose and what supporters seem to be responding to. But practically, how do you do that? How do you do it? It's not just the, you know, the deportation. It's building the wall and, yeah, and getting Mexico
to pay for. Can you imagine Mexico paying for this?
It just doesn't make sense. But yet, obviously, his message is resonating with a lot of people because
there's
you see the
segment,
crowds.
Certainly of the, a minority of a minority a party. I think really, and I sit down and look, not only just that, he has some other views when it comes to racial and particularly female issues. I look at Donald Trump, and I was talking to a bunch of people yesterday, and they were some of them took a little issue with me saying I was being very fair. But my own opinion was Donald Trump physically, and he seems to go after physical attributes of people. And I wonder, people that live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. Because, you know, if you put Donald Trump up next to Brad Pitt, he doesn't fare too well. You know? And I'm saying to myself, he's had three wives. They were all these tall, statuesque, blonde women. But what if he had no money and all he had was a Social Security check? You know, I'm looking at, you know, Donald Trump physically is not a very, is not a handsome man at all. Physically. He's physically, he's simply not. And how far would he have gotten with no money?
Well, that's a good question, but unfortunately, he does have the money.
Yeah.
He does,
you know,
have
and
the money.
And this so is, and I said this, I'm saying, he's busy talking about people, and of course, Carly Fiorina, I think her name is. Hope I'm getting it right.
Farina,
Carly Fiorina. You know, I would not. Her policies do not sit well with me. Yes, her policies are simply no better than any other conservative Republican's policy, notwithstanding the fact that she's a woman. You know, she's anti a lot of things that I think most women have been fighting for years to try and get. And but still in all, you know, talking about her face, well, I said, you know, Mr. Trump, your face doesn't look any better than Carly's, really.
Well, you know, it comes back. We were just talking earlier about, you know, gender biases and so forth. So it comes back to saying that that's another area.
Where you think that you can do this to her. You can say this about, well, the drawdown or the kickback or how the most insulting you can say to a woman is that, oh, you're ugly. Well, you know, so you're ugly.
you know.
Well, the thing is, it's not just that, too. I mean, again, we look at what women make as compared to men.
And men, yeah.
The, mm-hmm. You know, the gender biases.
75% of every dollar, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We need to work on. And women's health issues, are major mm-hmm. issues, particularly reproductive health. So, this campaign is getting to be one that is so focused on Mr. Trump, mm-hmm. whereas
he sucked all the oxygen out of the room. That's for sure.
Yeah, he does, mm-hmm. and he's a showman. So mm-hmm. We'll see how far the show will go.
Mm-hmm. You know, you wonder sometimes when you start listening to these different people who support him and their attitudes about certain things. Now, you were kind of forged, and I imagine a lot of the things that you feel now came about from the experience you've had over political activity, other social activity that you try to do. You could say that you were a community activist, and how all of these things have perhaps went to forge a lot of who Barbara Seals Nevergold mm-hmm. is today,
mm-hmm.
given what you have gone through. And, you know, you have to sometimes wonder when you listen to this, my goodness, where are these people coming from? Mm-hmm. Because you wonder, if you feel this way against Mexicans, or different other people of color, that's a very little short jump to feeling that way against other people. And when they were really going after the 14th Amendment, that really perked my interest in a big way. The 14th Amendment really is what guaranteed citizenship to African Americans. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that made you a citizen of this country. And I'm listening to them say, they're going after the 14th Amendment. What? You know, there's no way that I wouldn't fight for all I was worth for that, because that's what made me and my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents citizen, because my great-grandmother was really 10 years old when she was out of slavery. Mm. You know, and so I'm saying to myself, this is bothersome. And when you think of the assaults on these things, these are the underpinnings of a lot of things.
Well, yeah, and again, you know, kind of bringing this all back, I guess, to education mm-hmm. is, you know, why education is so critical.
And most people don't even know what the 14th Amendment was.
Yeah,
and that's really bothering.
Understanding the history mm-hmm. of things like the 14th Amendment, and really the broad impact mm-hmm. it had on this country and the society and the country mm-hmm. we became, it seems that people are easily able to dismiss those kinds of things because they don't understand it, because mm-hmm. they don't have the knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and then it becomes, oh, we don't want these women coming across the border having babies, and they become citizens,
mm-hmm.
As if the babies, you know, mm-hmm. are somehow to blame mm-hmm. because their parents mm-hmm. found a way to come to this country. So it's a debate. It's a national debate. I hope that that we get some calmer heads and mm-hmm. you know, some people are, because it's an emotional debate too, and people go on emotion.
I kind of weigh, and a lot of people say what we're seeing now when you look at television, which should be an education for young people if they're looking at television. The migrant situation that's going on in Europe right now, I am not that sympathetic to Europeans because of the colonial history. But it wasn't so much Eastern Europeans that should be faulted for this as Western Europeans. And I am talking about the British, the French, you know, the Norwegians, the Belgians, and some others who should really be bearing the brunt of this. But they're not as close, Asia as these other countries are. And so they're certainly not feeling it. But when I think, I'm saying, you know, a lot of this is what there's nothing like looking in the mirror and seeing payback coming your way, you know, because of what you did in these places. And it's like people talk about Syria. I mean, after the First World War, Syria was just carved up to suit the benefit of Western power, particularly the British and the French. And this is the mess that created Syria, basically. They didn't care how they divide these countries up.
Like it does seem though that countries like Germany, are mm-hmm. are stepping up,
mm-hmm.
And we have to think about the fact that the world economy is being impacted by all of this.
Oh yes,
and the world mm-hmm. economy includes the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We will all be responsible, you know, for what happens to those refugees.
The United States had its share of its hand in a lot of these things that go on in the Middle East, you know, a lot of these different things. You know, and I guess the big thing is when I look back, and there's two things I could never really understand, and I would get into big arguments with this. Why does a little country like Cuba, and who had been persecuted for 50 years by the heavy hand of the United States, yet there is actually no illiteracy in Cuba? Most Cubans, almost 99% of all Cubans in Cuba, can read and write in Spanish, just about all. And the best medical system in South America comes from Cuba. But you wonder, how do these people do this? And like, I'm trying to think of the number now that we were so heavily involved in. Think of education, not Chavez, but I'm trying to, it'll come to you. As soon as I stop talking, it'll come to the country. It always does. You know, and you think of these people who fought so hard for primary education. Why is it in the United States that we have illiteracy? You know, why is it in the United States that we have crumbling schools? And not only crumbling schools, but the neighborhoods that surround the schools, the people there,
well,
you know, and all
me,
these things impact.
Questions that, you know, I think that are being constantly asked and that we're asking ourselves. You know, certainly when we look at urban school districts and we see some of the issues that we're facing, and you look at urban communities and you see the mirror effect of the impact that poverty has, poor housing has, poor nutrition has on education. There is a connection, and so while we're trying to improve the schools, we also have to improve the neighborhoods from which the children come.
That is so true. And I think it was someone else that when you stop and talk, I've never seen in my life, I can remember when I was coming up in school, people kind of taught to respect teachers. I'm not saying that every teacher is as good as everyone else, you know. There are certainly some bad teachers, you know, or there are certainly a lot of teachers who don't feel that children of color are going to go anywhere anyway, so why bother trying to teach them anything? And they do exist in the school system. But, you know, but the assault on teachers as a whole and their union is something I think is unprecedented.
It's gotten, unfortunately, very, very bad. And, I mean, every profession certainly has people who don't belong in it. But the teaching profession is a profession. It's difficult. There are many fine teachers, and the assault on teaching really has, resulted in some degree to people leaving the profession or people not entering the
profession.
Has
this surprised you at all? And especially people, when you see people like and not only Mr. Palladino, who certainly has his share of demons. I think he better not worry about a place in heaven. I don't think he's going there anytime soon. But you have people like Mr. Radford, who also has gone after teachers in such a big way. And you wonder sometimes, you know, has this ever surprised you?
Well, it's a national trend, Mary. It is not just Buffalo. It is national, that teachers are under attack. That teachers, are not getting the respect and the credit they deserve. You have to, I mean, this is the subject really of another, I think, a program because it's so extensive and there's so many layers to it. But it is definitely a field that has lost, respect that it should have. And it's not just happening in Buffalo as an isolated case. It's happening across the nation.
Do you find this surprising? I mean, when you first started, and I'm sure you had to deal with it because you certainly come at school board meetings. In fact, right around this table, we had Phil Romero was here at one time. Mr. Radford was here at one time. Is it Radford? I'm always missing.
Radford, yes.
And also on the line with us was Terry Melvin, who is with the AFL-CIO. He is the secretary treasurer of the New York State AFL-CIO. And he went after him about unions not caring about kids. And I was amazed because Terry Melvin is also a minister, mm-hmm. you know, associate pastor of a very large church, I think. And I've never seen a minister get that mad. You know, and it was something for me. He was on the phone, but I mean, he totally went bananas, you know, on Radford. And I said to myself, and I looked at Phil Romora's face, I don't think he had been in a room. I would imagine that he should have been. I mean, he's the president of this union. He must have been in negotiations where things are pretty heated. But I was simply amazed at the mistrust and the attitude toward teachers and their union.
Well, you know, as I said, in terms of the national mm-hmm. debate and the national issues that are going on, many of them are directed toward eliminating or reducing the mm-hmm. The clout of the union. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's public unions.
Progressive?
Well, it's public unions, period. Look mm-hmm. at Wisconsin and what happened with the public, you know, the public
employees.
And look what
they got as a governor.
Unions. So, right. So, the you know, the impact that unions have mm-hmm. is being lessened every day or assaulted every day. Mm-hmm. And, it you know, it's a complex thing that, mm-hmm. you know, relates to money, relates mm-hmm. to education as a money field, mm-hmm. Even as we, you know, as we know how important it is to have our children educated. There's a lot of money mm-hmm. that goes into education, and mm-hmm. there are private and industries mm-hmm. that want to get the money. Mm-hmm. Some of it has to do with standardized testing, mm-hmm. textbooks, mm-hmm. You know, private schools, vouchers.
Yeah.
All of that taking away from public education mm-hmm. and moving the money into somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's kind of simplistic that mm-hmm. I'm saying, but
it is taking
again,
place.
It's taking place mm-hmm. in every corner of this nation, mm-hmm. There's a struggle going on to save public education. Mm-hmm. And to do that is also to save educators mm-hmm. And not, you know, not have students become the pawns mm-hmm. in this whole fight. But unfortunately, they are. The standardized testing mm-hmm. you know, is another major area of concern. Mm-hmm. This past year, over 200,000 children opted not to take the standardized testing in New York State.
Why do you think that was so?
I know it was so because my granddaughter was one of those children mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. Her parents opted her out mm-hmm. because the exams are not developmentally.
Are they skewed to one way or
they're not
another?
Developmentally appropriate. If mm-hmm. you looked at the exams for a third grader, mm-hmm. The reading you would find was somewhere rated around sixth grade level.
For a third grader?
For a third grader. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, essentially saying, those who support those exams, that we're raising the expectations of educators, you mm-hmm. know, of education. We're raising the expectations. We have to have standards that require rigor, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Well, all of us, I believe, expect and have high expectations for our children mm-hmm. and want them to get the best education and want there to be rigor. But we don't want to give them exams that are slated to make them fail.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the one thing that really also struck me here in this whole fight about charter schools, it seems as though the people who are pushing this the hardest, and I'm talking about the ones that I have had a chance to observe personally who have been on this show, were African-American. And it seems as though there seemed to have been some kind of financial incentive behind some of that drive for charter schools. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that has been your opinion. It may not be your opinion at all. But if you see some other motive other than, we just love kids and want to go to charter schools.
Well,
when Mr. Radford was here, I got that distinct impression that he had some other motive.
Well, I think that there are charter schools that are excellent schools. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not opposed to charter schools, mm-hmm. but I think what has happened is that the supposition is that we have a bad public school, we can fix it mm-hmm. by bringing a charter school in or making it a charter school. Mm-hmm. And not all charter schools are performing as well as public schools. So mm-hmm. there needs to be a balance, and there needs to be some real research into mm-hmm. Charter schools that work well, mm-hmm. but there are charter schools that don't.
Will that be something that you think the board might be taking up in this new term.
The board has been taking it up ever since. Ever since the new board took office and wanted to turn some of our schools and over to charter schools. So that was a major issue.
That was quite a big fight, I think, for a while there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, that was led, I think, by Mr. Palladino again.
And Mr. Quinn.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is Mr. Quinn's? I have an opinion about Mr. Palladino. I feel that he's simply used to having yes people around him, and you know, don't do as I say, not or else type of thing. Mr. Quinn, I don't know that much about.
Well, I think, you know, philosophically, mm-hmm. Ideologically or what have you, he does have a belief, certainly, in providing quality education for children. Mm-hmm. And I think his belief does incorporate and lean toward more into a charter school provision. So, I think if you have some time and take a look at the school board meetings, you'll get a better sense of where Mr. Quinn is coming from.
Well, I noticed there's another guest that's been on here. I'm pretty sure you must be familiar with her, Joan Simmons.
Yes.
And she attends quite a few board meetings, has some very definite ideas about things that she wants to be done. And her opinion, and she doesn't mind expressing them at all, has been not very complimentary of the majority board members. Mm-hmm. She seems to have a pretty low opinion of them. People basically, and I don't know everyone's background. I don't think Mr. Quinn has a background in education, and certainly Mr. Palladino does not. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the other three members that make up the 5-member majority.
Right.
I know that one is a retired cop.
No, you're talking about Ms. Pierce?
I understand.
She does currently work in law enforcement.
I thought there was a male member who was a retired police captain or something of that. That's not the case. Okay. But I don't think that any of them have, say, like a teaching background.
No, they do not. Mm-hmm. I think diversity is good to have on the board. Diversity, not, you know, in educational background and experience coming to the board. So I really don't believe that everybody needs to be an educator, but I do believe that we need to educate ourselves so that we can be the best board member
possible to be.
Right.
Our interview with Time with Barbara Nevergo has almost come to an end. I want to thank you for being my guest and certainly hope you come back. I want to also take this time to wish, if I were Baptist, I would say my pastor, but our priest and Barbara used to belong to the same church that I do now,
yes.
St. Philip, and that Gloria Payne Carter is celebrating her 10th anniversary as the presiding priest of St. Philip's Episcopal Church. And that is going to take place today, and we wish her well in that new endeavor and hope that Mother Payne Carter continues on. And so we're saying father this or father that. Now we know we have a mother this or a mother that, you know, and that everything goes well with her. And congratulations on her 10th anniversary here. And before we close out, Barb, is there anything you want to leave us with?
In terms
that
of...
maybe the good spirit strikes Mr. Palladino.
Now you're going to use my time. No, I would just think that, the education of our children is paramount, and the quality education is paramount. And so we're working hard in the Buffalo School District to ensure that happens.
Thank you again for being my guest. I'm your host, Mary Davis. Stay with this station throughout your day.
You've been listening to The Mary Davis Show. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Mary Davis, 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.